My working definition when I work with individuals is this. Self-compassion is a state of thinking and feeling that prepares the individual to take positive, empowered, and deliberate action. And why I state it that way is because there's an incredible intentionality behind this state. There's very little automatic or excusatory about this state. And in fact, self-compassion requires us to tap into a source of courage as we make these decisions. Because anyone who's ever done anything hard knows there are pitfalls, there are challenges, there's fear, there's emotional pain, there's letdown. And so we have to be willing to create a relationship with the parts of ourselves that are suffering or aren't feeling amazing at that moment so that we can work through it.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As a naturopathic doctor and anthropologist, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people exactly like you. Your business, body, balance, and inner badass, these are the themes we are exploring. So I will admit, when I was approached by my colleague, Dr. Hoswar Shahi, Dr. K for short, in our office, and he proposed the topic for this podcast, I had a really bad internal attitude. Yasher came to me and he said, Megan, I think an amazing topic for a podcast, because we had talked about doing another one together, is to talk about the benefits of self-compassion. And his suggestion came to me on the tail end of 3 days of intensive work and overextending myself. And my immediate first thought when I was in that state of fatigue was, ugh, the last thing I want to do is talk about something that is just going to slow us all down. I really thought that, and I'm really sharing it with you because I know that this is the dialogue that so many of you have when we talk about the idea of self-compassion, when you're coming at it from a place of deep fatigue. And so on the heels of a podcast I did a few weeks ago around the notion of radical restoration and how we actually renew ourselves on a daily basis, I was really excited to actually move this topic forward. In fact, it only took about 5 minutes of talking through Yasher and listening to him discuss how self-compassion is actually an act of leadership to pull me from my own personal trenches back to that place where I actually like to hang out. And that is a mindset of prevention and self-respect and all of the other things that I really, really genuinely and authentically like to bring to the table. And so if I talk about and introduce this notion of self-compassion and any part of you is like, ugh, I'm not sure I really have time to go there, or maybe it's not for me, or maybe next year when this year settles out a little bit, or maybe once I make a little bit more money or hire the nanny or whatever other future state you think needs to be in place before you start to care for yourself from a compassionate place, then let me tell you, this podcast has been created entirely for you. See, the thing about self-compassion is that self-compassion is an act of leadership, not towards just yourself, but towards your team and your family and the people that you influence as well. In fact, moving to that next level of your life, moving to that place where you start to integrate the lessons that have come to you along the way, will require that how you engage in self-compassion starts to change. Self-compassion is not pouring a glass of wine at the end of the day. Self-compassion is not necessarily having a bubble bath or getting your toes done. Self-compassion is about the way that you speak to yourself. And I really can't think of anyone better to take us through the neuroscience of self-compassion, to speak to us like the true mindset ninja that he is, than my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Yasher Hoswarshahi. He is an immensely intelligent, compassionate person. I am so lucky to have him on my team, and I cannot wait for you guys to go deep with us now on the neuroscience of self-compassion. My friend, Dr. K. Dr. Yasher Hoswarshahi, welcome to the Entrepology Podcast.
Thank you so much, Megan. A pleasure to be back.
For the record, moving forward, we're going to refer to you as Yasher or Dr. K so that we can stay in that awesome place of me making sure that I pronounce your name correctly.
Done. Deal.
Yes. Okay. I'm really excited to jump into this conversation today. And I think today is actually a really timely day to have it. Today, we're going to be talking about this concept of self-compassion and why it is so difficult for high achievers and go-getters and entrepreneurs to get into the mindset of self-compassion. And also, I think we're also going to just break down some of the myths around what self-compassion is really all about. And before we do that and get into it really deep, I'd love for you to just take people through. I know they've heard about you and you've been on the podcast before, but can you just back up a little bit and give us a little bit of context as to why this is an area where you are particularly passionate and how these types of conversations play out for you in practice? How do we get to this place in your career?
Such an important conversation, and I come from it from a very personal and professional lens. The personal side of it is I've always wanted to be a high performer. I wanted to show up to life at my best. I wanted to be a leader. And I therefore did all the things I thought I needed to do to get it right on paper, from the athletics to the academics to music and beyond. And what I really found was that I was chasing this feeling, and achievement kept giving me these feelings. But there was times where I didn't feel good no matter how much I was achieving. And so that brought me down a very dark and lonely place where I actually speak about it on my TEDx lecture, and it's where I essentially wanted to end my own life. And despite having it all very much laid out on paper in a quote unquote perfect way. And it was so much so that in that moment in the car where I was having, you know, these really dark thoughts and feelings, and I literally had my hands wrapped around my throat, squeezing as hard as I could, I had a thought pop up in my head in the middle of this as I'm crying and losing breath that essentially asked me, are you sure this is the only way to face your pain? And I have no idea why that question popped up. I have no idea where that question came from, but it caught my attention in so many ways. One, because I knew the answer was no, somewhere deep inside of me. And the other was because if I was to do this medicine and be part of this medicine and to take this medicine, I needed to show up in a much different way. And that was a very humbling moment in my life. And since then, I've become very interested in this idea of compassion, this idea of self-compassion, and really how it applies to high performance. And so to fast forward and having these conversations with individuals in clinic, you know, I'm kind of seeing the same patterns. They have it all figured out in the quote-unquote societal way of determining success, but they feel disconnected. They don't feel very empowered in their own lives, and they don't know necessarily how to work through these emotions. So when I ask them, hey, what if I gave you this magic pill called self-compassion, and as soon as you popped it down the hatch, you were given 100% self-compassion, what would change? And they often look at me very confused, but when they bring their thoughts around to the idea, they look up with these wide eyes saying, everything. And I would ask them, how would you change the way you treat yourself? And they would again say, oh my gosh, I wouldn't be the way I am with myself. I would be kinder. I'd be more gentle. I would be more, you know, focused on the things that really mattered and brought me happiness and joy in my family. And so, you know, on and on we go. So it really started bringing to light the need for us to place attention on this conversation in not a lip service way, but what are the tools and what is the brain science saying so that we can actually perform at our best? We can be the leaders and the go-getters and the badass version of ourselves that we all want to be.
So to that end, and I'm loving this. I actually have a million places that I want to go with him. And we work together in the same clinic at Anthropology Performance Lab. So we're working with a lot of the same people. And one thing I want to clarify is, what does self-compassion actually mean? Because I know when we drop that term, I have some patients who look at me and they're like, I already have a bath with a glass of wine twice a week. And I was like, that's awesome. It's not what I'm talking about. So like, when you talk about self-compassion, what are you referring to?
This is the definition I love giving everyone, because you're absolutely right. Somehow we all believe it's about, you know, a bag of Doritos or a glass of wine or a hot bath or Netflix or whatever.
Ice cream. Don't forget ice cream.
And ice cream. The list is very long. And yes, you're right. Ice cream is very high on that list. But my working definition when I work with individuals is this. Self-compassion is a state of thinking and feeling that prepares the individual to take positive, empowered, and deliberate action. And why I state it that way is because there's an incredible intentionality behind this state. There's very little automatic or excusatory about this state. And in fact, self-compassion requires us to tap into a source of courage as we make these decisions. Because anyone who's ever done anything hard knows there are pitfalls, there are challenges, there's fear, there's emotional pain, there's letdown. And so we have to be willing to create a relationship with the parts of ourselves that are suffering or aren't feeling amazing at that moment so that we can work through it. By ignoring it, we're simply doing that. We're ignoring it. So again, it's a state of thinking and feeling that prepares us to take positive, empowered, and deliberate action.
I love that piece, and I love that definition. And as someone who themselves will struggle with this concept of self-compassion, how do I start to get into that mindset? Like, what is step one of moving towards that place? Because that is a much more evolved way of thinking than I think the tactics and strategies a lot of successful people have used to get to where they are at in their careers or their life or otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's three pillars that researchers constantly refer to identify what self-compassion looks like. And I'll go through them in a second. But what I want to say first is that the number one and most critical idea around this is that we have to have a desire and, again, an intention to create a self-to-self witnessing or relationship, to be able to enter this version of ourselves, a wiser version of ourselves that's willing to pay witness to and bring awareness to our suffering. So I think without that first commitment that I want to do this differently than I've normally done, and I want to create a self-to-self relationship where I can work through some of this pain or challenge, then we're really just, again, throwing ideas out there, but we're not ingraining it or attaching it to the identity that we want to evolve into. So I'll start there. And then once that's set in some capacity, then we can go down the three pillars. And so these three pillars are, number one, mindfulness. So again, observing our own thoughts or emotions in a non-judgmental way. That in itself takes dedication, right? To be able to just pay attention and see where I'm at, what I'm feeling without being judgmental about it. And this is being present even the moments that feel negative. We're so used to talking about, you know, this positive self-talk and these affirmations and to blow through pain that sometimes what happens, we just ignore the pain, and that is not useful in any way. And by bringing this mindfulness to it, we can start adding our own definition and meaning to what this practice means to us, to our work, or to our community. So that's pillar one. Pillar two would be what's called common humanity. And what happens, and I'm sure everyone listening and even yourself, Megan, can relate to this. When we're down in the dumps, it's very easy to think I'm the only one that suffers this way, or I'm the only one that has this problem. Your mind almost plays a trick on you, making you feel very isolated. And so common humanity brings awareness to the idea that suffering is a universal experience. I always say to my patients, congratulations, you're human. You know, you're allowed to experience these things. And just that permission to feel pain or sadness can be very empowering for people, especially those who are constantly trying to move the needle forward and not really have the time or energy or space to slow down. So we have mindfulness. We have this common humanity that's the antidote to isolation or isolating thoughts. And then we have self-kindness. This is language. How would you speak to someone that you cared about deeply, a friend or a family member? And are you using the same language and supportive ideas towards yourself? Another way I like to describe self-kindness is it's like self-coaching. I always like to bring my patients or my clients to the space that they can actually start coaching themselves, and they get this mental reel that is more empowering for them. So when we put mindfulness, common humanity and self-kindness through language together, we're actually now practicing what scientists will call self-compassion.
And what do we do? I love the framework, by the way. When we have people who are going to listen to that, I'm pushing back on this because I hear the pushback. Do you get the pushback in office?
All the time.
Great. Okay, good. Time, yeah. I just wanted to make sure that I was not somehow having this unique experience, and I didn't think I was. They're like, I totally hear you, and I want to get there. I just can't right now because of X, Y, or Z. How do we interrupt the limiting beliefs that somehow somebody's life, I don't mean to say is so unique because I'm not actually trying to judge it. When you're literally caught in that place where you believe you can't slow down or you can't stop, or the one that I perceive a lot from people is that if they slow down or stop, and you and I talked about this because I feel like this sometimes when I get caught in a frenetic state, if I slow down or stop or engage in a conversation around self-compassion, I'm going to lose momentum. It's all going to fall apart.
Depends on what they need from me. But if they're the research minded, I would say the research doesn't support your thoughts. And just because they're your thoughts doesn't make them necessarily correct about this. So the research would be very clear that it doesn't make you lazy or less motivated. In fact, that's probably one of the biggest myths surrounding self-compassion. And it actually makes you more engaged in a healthier way. So the reality is this. I could beat myself into doing something, but I also can support myself. Again, like think of a good coach on the sidelines.
Yeah.
You know, like I can also motivate myself differently. Instead of me saying to myself, Yasha, you better not stop because you have this momentum going and you're going to screw it up if you do. I can say, Yasha, you're so engaged in this and you're so about this right now. I know you're feeling tired. Do you need like a 5-minute break? But then we can get back into this because you're doing such a great job of it. Why not keep it up right now? I know it's challenging, but I believe in you. That's what a good coach would say. It would acknowledge the fact that this is a challenging time. It would acknowledge the fact that you feel motivated, but also there is some fear to you slowing down. And it would come up with an idea that honors both your excitement for the task, but also the need to take a breath. Because we would not ask the people that we care about to burn themselves out so they're no use to themselves or the people around them anymore, just because maybe at the end they'll get somewhere. You know, and the best performers always talk about these transition periods in the day. You know, I know you and I both talk about Brendon Burchard a lot, and he talks about as you walk through these the door frames, and these are transition periods. So how many door frames do we walk through in a day? This is not about taking 10 days off and doing a silent meditation retreat. This is about getting real with where you're at and using language, breath work, mindfulness, thought processes, whatever you want to say, to re-engage in a way that makes you feel reconnected and excited and not working out of fear, but out of an idea of I have more in me and I can give more, if that is the truth.
Mm-hmm. And I think the reality is that those are the strategies that evolved high performers start to use.
Yes.
Because it's how you tap into physiological and psychological sustainability.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Exactly. And we can't just put, you know, we know this, like, again, intellectually, we know this. It's just, we have to bring it into integration in our lives. And when people learn, again, you know, we use various technologies in our clinic, but something, again, as simple as heart rate variability or biofeedback device, when they see that literally they can shift from a burnt out, stressed out nervous system signature to a rest, recover, ready to perform in the zone, in the pocket, however you want to say it, a nervous system signature within a matter of seconds, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, sometimes even less, then there's no excuse. Now, this is just a limiting belief, as you said. This is I was wired to think a certain way, but now I have proof that I can enter the zone by simply reconfiguring my thought process around this.
Yeah. And I think for a lot of high achievers in that category, a lot of recovering perfectionists, and a lot of people who have been very successful with a strategy throughout the course of their life of negative self-talk or, you know, get back up, you lazy, whatever, or like it really has been a strategy that has gotten them to a certain point. But I don't know about you. I have never seen anyone be able to leverage that strategy to actually get them to the top of their own potential. So I'm not talking about societal potential, because I do get people who come in and like, listen, I've been talking like this to myself my whole life, and that's the reason I'm a CEO. And I'm like, you're also miserable. Right. So I'm not assigning that to a certain level of career stature or financial stature. I'm talking about your highest potential as a person. I've just never seen someone simultaneously sit in their highest state of potential while not engaging in some element of self-compassion.
Amen, sister. Okay. That's all I have to say. You nailed it. And that's the conversation. Look, great, you have X amount of dollars in your bank account. Great, you have this business or that house or whatever, again, societal's definition of success is, if you're miserable, you have failed, right? You have failed, because how much more can you engage in your life, in your family's life, in your community, in your work, if you actually enjoyed yourself, if you actually took the time? And no one here, at least not you and I know, will dismiss the idea of working hard. No one is about that conversation. We know that you got to pull up your socks and you have to do the work. But what we're saying is there's a psychological and physiological way of doing it so that you don't go home and self-medicate or disengage from your family, or just wake up every morning thinking, ugh, I got to do this again, and really not see any worth or value in these activities.
Okay, so I love where you're going with that piece. And I want to actually transition, not the whole conversation, of all the conversation, to talking about those who are in a leadership role and how they can start to facilitate a culture of self-compassion. Because I have heard from people in leadership roles in a variety of contexts. Some people I know inside of work, outside of work, like life, I listen to them talk about the people they work with, and they're like, oh, the biggest challenge is so-and-so is not willing to give up any time of their family to move ahead. Or, you know, these darn millennials want to go to a yoga class, or they're so concerned about their feelings that they can't. And it's really interesting, because I think what's happening is there's this black and white conversation about self-compassion. Either I have a culture of self-compassion and therefore my team doesn't engage, or I just have to be this sort of ruthless dictator and they've got to get a job done. How do we shift the conversation as leaders so that we're driving and facilitating a culture where we are still executing at our highest potential and our team is executing at their highest potential, but we're also ensuring that it's happening from a self-sustaining mindset?
Yeah. So I have to, before I even fully dive into that question, I have to say that when I work with leaders, I'm very clear on the first step to any of this work is you have to become a self-aware leader. You need to know what your triggers are. You need to know what your identity is as a leader, and you need to know how you work with them, because everything is always hunky-dory until there's a conflict. And a conflict is simply, like as you mentioned, any form of an unmet need. That could be within a business partner. That could be within the whole department. It's just a matter of the relationship is breaking down because we're not seeing eye to eye on a matter. And so to the leaders, I'd say conflict is your job. Leadership and conflict go hand in hand, and you can't fear conflict. You have to embrace it. So that's the first thing. You have to be able to know that others are going to see things differently, and how you show up to that conflict is going to make all the difference. And we are, like you said, no longer in a place and time where we could do the carrot and the stick and expect the highest potential of human thought and performance as our return. So we have to be able to have the conversation. And to have the conversation, we have to be able to know how the brain works, and we have to be able to know how to transition through conflict so that people feel connected to our message and connected to our purpose. And I have to tell you right now, no leader is going to take it to the next level, at least not with people in their team that are doing it solely because they're scared. You're getting a minor return when you can get a major return by engaging in their excitement, engaging in their way of refueling and understanding how they need to work. So, you know, if you like, I can dive into probably the driving the three models or systems of the brain and how we have to manage these emotions so that we can actually do the work we want to do. Would that be useful?
It'd be so useful, because I think what happens is so much of people's behavior is driven by an attempt to avoid emotions that they're uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
And so we get caught in these cycles of really not pushing through to our evolved selves, especially, and whether we're talking about we're leaders at work, I think we're all leaders in our own life first. Yes. And we engage in so much compensatory behavior so that we don't have to go to painful places. And I think half the time the places aren't even painful. We just think they might be.
Yeah. Or they're just unfamiliar because we haven't taken the time to go there and explore.
Yeah. No, I'd love it. Let's do it.
Okay. So just, I'll say this in a very high level way, that there's three systems to managing our emotions. And oftentimes they're out of balance. And so one of the systems may be in hyperdrive and the others are kind of weak muscles. It's like the stabilizer muscles. Everyone does the curls and the squats and the bench press, but they don't really want to work on some of the stabilizing muscles that really are going to help you get stronger in those lifts. So I feel like the emotional systems in the brain can kind of parallel that analogy. So there's three systems, being the threat system, the soothe system, and the drive system. And these are constantly going to be working and almost competing against one another at all times. So the threat system is just what it sounds. It aims to protect us and prepare us from running away from physical and psychological threats. So this gets us worrying about things. And if we're not careful, we would start entering exactly what you just mentioned, the better safe than sorry type of thinking, right? So we can identify these as anger, fear, anxiety, disgust. And this is produced by cortisol in our body. Then we move to the soothe network. And this helps us do exactly that, soothe, manage stress, and also bond with others. You have these feelings of contentment or safety, trust and connection. And this is very much, oxytocin gets a lot of credit for as a hormone that's produced here. Different opioids also are produced in this framework or this model. And then finally, we have the drive system. And this is what it sounds like. Again, it's aiming us, it's motivating us to achieve more. It's reward-based. It's feelings of excitement, focus, and wanting. And this is where the entrepreneurs and most leaders live. And it's the dopamine, right? It's the stimulation and excitement. Here's the part that I love sharing with people. Most often, when people are in a hyper-threat state and have a very weakened soothe state, they automatically go to what's left, the drive state. That's why you have those people who are actually working extra hard to prove something. I was one of them, by the way, so this is no judgment on anyone else. You work extra hard to prove yourself through worth by societal standards. You want to achieve more and be more. But meanwhile, you haven't taken the time to work the stabilizing muscle of soothe. Again, of managing your stress better, bonding with others better. And I mean in a deep way. We can all fake it till we make it, but I want us actually to be it so we don't have to fake it. And so when you have this threat response and you go to this drive response, you're almost stuck back and forth, threat, drives, threat, drive. And when you try to enter soothe, it gets awkward and weird. And you say, well, I'm just going to have the glass of wine. Or I mean, like, there, buddy bear. But that's not actually going to work. And what's fascinating is the drive network. Again, we've made it super sexy in our society by entrepreneurial and leadership and monetary status. But it's also the same network that is in quote unquote overdrive when you're addicted to heroin or cocaine or any other drug or any other binge Netflix or binge online shopping or the comfort foods. These are the things that we have to really become mindful of, because it's not just about the glitz and glamour. It's also what drives us down the path of destruction. And so when we have an ability to recognize threat for what it is, to be able to soothe when we need to in an ongoing state, that doesn't necessarily, again, mean slow down so you're not engaged, but check in so you're able to engage better, then our drive network, our drive emotional system is ready to click on and like a heat-seeking missile to the things that matter, and then we can give all of ourselves to it. And I think if we do not honor this system, then we're simply, again, reducing the return on investment on any activity, whether we're a leader or whether, you know, in the business or a leader in the home or wherever else you wanna be a leader.
Yeah. And what I love about this too, Yasha, is I have a process I take my patients through, and you're going to be like, huh, why haven't you shared this with me before? I talked about it on a podcast just a few weeks ago, and it's this notion of radical restoration. And it's so similar to what you just talked about. I was talking about it on a physiological, and you're talking about how we layer basically the mindset onto it. But I took people through what I call the three R's, the renew, recover, and restore. Renew being the things that we can do every single day so that we have cellular renewal. The second, in terms of recover, like creating time and space so the body can actually engage in physiological recovery. And to the point of what you were just talking about, this notion of deep restoration, this idea of how do we actually take a step back so that we can create an element of clarity within our system, and we can renew that energy. And I was talking about it in the context of entrepreneurs and people who need to execute at a high level. You're not at your best when you're trying to like climb and claw your way across the finish line and hope for that vacation or light at the end of the tunnel. You're at your best when you actually renew in front of those periods of execution. And what's so cool about what you just talked about is you engaged and created language around the mindset piece. How do we actually start to renew from a mindset piece, which is where it has to start, so that we're executing at that high place? So it's really kind of cool that these two concepts are colliding in such a real way. We should work together.
Maybe one day. No, you're absolutely right. And again, it's about time we just disregard or dismiss or move away out of focus the idea that the mind and the body are separate. Like, let's stop having this separation of conversation. There's a mind-body and a body-mind connection. And anytime you try to separate the two, again, your return on investment drops. So if you're actually about showing up to life, you're actually about leading or creating, then you would honor these things. You will honor these things because you know it's part of the major pillars that make you, again, be the best version of yourself. So yes, I agree fully.
Yeah. And we can't, the thing is about the mindset piece, we can, and you use the term fake until you make it at a different point in this podcast, but we can pretend in so many other areas. We just can't pretend around the mindset piece.
Right.
And that's what comes back to bite us. And what I really don't want for people is for anyone to be like, oh gosh, you're so right. And to default to that place where there's a sense of shame around the fact that, you know, maybe we've got healthcare practitioners, we've got health coaches, or we've got other people who are in this community, they're hanging out on this podcast and they're like, you're right, I've been totally faking it. And then they go to this place where I'm inauthentic. And can we just hit pause and validate all of those feelings and talk about how we can start to move forward? And I know you and I had discussed this notion of a self-compassion detox.
Yes.
But can we just like hit pause for everybody for 1 second and just give everyone like the next step moving forward? Because I don't want anyone to engage in this judgment of themselves related to where they are at on this journey. Because this is a journey. Like, no one's born with this.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason why we probably struggle so much with this is because you have to ask yourself, again, when was the last time someone taught you this? When was the last time you entered into the quote unquote mind gym of this type of work? And really, for majority of us, again, it's infrequent or never. And so you're absolutely right. And guess what? I'll even take it the next step to really bring in this common humanity idea in this conversation and say, the first step to compassion starts with a stress response. So this is the interesting thing. Compassion starts when the brain says, holy moly, I'm suffering. Mm-hmm. And so there are these empathy regions of the brain, these structures that are responsible for difficult emotions, for pain, but also for love and care. It's the emotional salience regions where it grabs your attention. And so if you don't have that moment of stress response, then you're actually not paying attention. You don't care. It's habituated. So anyone on the listening to this podcast, wherever you are, if you felt a moment, a pang of, uh-oh, congratulations. That's your first step to starting self-compassionate journey. It's what we do after that makes the difference. Most of us feel that, then try to self-medicate or work harder. What I'm suggesting and what the neuroscience is suggesting is, congratulations, you made the first step. Let's add steps to it so you have more tools in your toolbox and you're not simply reaching for the chocolate cake and the wine or the ice cream or whatever as your only tool. And it makes all the sense in the world that you would, because you just entered a stress response. We just have to move on from that so that we can be fully compassionate.
And as you're talking, I was thinking too about, you know, all these online coaches who are like, oh, it's about working smarter, not harder. And I've got all the strategies for you. And I think the reality is this is step one to working smarter, not harder.
Yes.
And none of those other strategies are really going to be available to your mindset until we open up to this concept of self-compassion and acknowledge all the limiting beliefs that keep us in that drive threat cycle, which I thought was a perfect way of describing what this piece looks like for people.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And what happens then again is you feel this pain or you feel this suffering and you say, okay, you know what? I'm going to be about it then. I'm going to take my time and effort and go through this journey. Well, the next step, your brain is going to enter what's called a default network of thinking. And this is when you start thinking about yourself, remembering the past, planning the future, social engagements, any sort of autobiographical tasks or thinking. And guess what increases this default network to go down the path of self-criticism, isolation, and worrying?
What?
You probably already guessed it. Judgment and shame. There you go. So now you're like, holy smokes. Now you stack two things against me. Not only do I have to feel the suffering, and then when I'm really about the suffering in a certain way and I become judgmental or shameful about the suffering, I'm only going to spiral out of control. Yeah, it is true. You will. So what we have to then do is we have to become aware of the suffering, but then we have to have a desire to connect to ourselves as we suffer. So not to judge ourselves, but to be there as a good friend would. Again, just everyone on the call right now, or I'm sorry, listening to this podcast right now, just think for a moment. When you were taken care of really well by a friend or a lover or a stranger, were they judging you? Were they telling you to get up and get over it? Or were they honoring the pain you're going through? When you were doing the same for somebody else, did you slap on the back and be like, you can do better, cowboy? Or did you sit there and say, wow, yeah, that really seems very difficult and challenging. And then we moved on, right? It's just that ability to have a self-to-self relationship. I can't say that enough, because if there's nothing else people pick up from this conversation, is that self-compassion is about a self-to-self witnessing. And when we are able to take the identity of who we are and really ingrain it in psychological anchors, characteristics, ideas, visions, and we really feel it, then we ask ourselves, how would that version of me sit with my suffering? So again, it's the self-to-self, the individual that's suffering and the part of my brain and thinking that can pay witness and speak to it. You know, when I ask people when they're suffering a year from now, how would you want to behave or respond to the suffering? They come up with answers that are really fruitful, that are very useful. So either they're completely insane or they've just engaged in the way our brain can think. We can actually separate ourselves from this pain. And this is where Western neuroscience is meeting Eastern philosophies of thought and meditation. It's really an interesting time we live in. So once we have that desire, then when we move on, our reward network is no longer hijacked to moving towards, you know, the things that feel good. Again, the binge eating and so on and so forth. We're not self-medicating. We're actually having this motivation to approach ourselves and the event or the feeling in a way that allows us to gain a sense of satisfaction, a sense of empoweredness, and a sense that we are not victims to these feelings any longer. We have control and a sense of agency around what's going on.
Yeah, and the thing I want to stress with everybody with all of these pieces is that this is an evolution. And as you're talking, I was like, these are the characteristics that I feel like so many of the people that I hang out with, myself, like evolving leaders want to have, including our patients. And it's one of the reasons and part of how we work together, because I want to give people context for that, is when we work with someone related to their health and we're looking at taking it to the next level, there's two questions that we ask after we meet a new patient. And that is, what is the state of their eating? Because that's something that happens every single day, multiple times a day. So is it spiraling them up or down? And what is the state of their thinking? And that's not in a judgment place, because we recognize as a team, we're all in an ongoing state of evolution with respect to the thoughts that we engage in. But is someone's thought patterning around where they're going in their health and their life something that's spiraling them up, spiraling them down, or keeping them stuck? And most of the time, we're in a place where we have some elements of thinking that are holding us stuck. And the way that as a team, we love to be able to engage Dr. K is that coming out of that intake, while we're simultaneously moving someone's health forward, you are simultaneously working on the thinking piece. So there's this awesome congruence of health and mindset that really accelerates people getting to the next level. But part of sharing that was, one, I wanted to know how we all work together. And two, just this acknowledgement of the fact that for leaders in general, that this is something just about everyone is going to end up engaging in, certainly in our clinic, because it's such a huge part of health.
Yeah. And again, I want to add to the layer of evolution and simply say that everyone right now listening to this interview, to this podcast, I want you to think of the area in your life that you feel that you have some form of expertise around. It could be baking, it could be business, it could be mechanics, it could be whatever you want it to be. And I want you to ask yourself, how good were you the day you started? Right? And so the only reason you are where you are and you feel you have some form of expertise is because you kept showing up through the challenge. You kept doing the work and you kept connected to the reasons why you want to do the work. And that's how you got to where you got. Building mindset muscles is the same way. We all start somewhere. Our pasts, our histories, our environments all play a role, but we all start somewhere. And then once we place the dedicated tools and time and energy to these workouts, as I always call them, then we build the muscles and we move towards having a more expertise approach to these challenges. And like I said, I shared my very personal story off the top. It's not about judgment. And the reason I share that story and the reason I shared it on the TEDx stage is because I thought to myself, what is one story I can share that actually will make a difference to the people that are listening or watching that talk? And so part of self-compassion, again, is knowing that you have to start somewhere and you can move up and you can always get better at it. And when we put away the idea that we either nail it or we don't, or we have to have it or we can't do it, then we leave space for possibility. And that's incredibly empowering.
Yeah, I love it. And I have so many places that I want to take this, but I want to introduce a concept to everybody because I have a million questions around this piece. And even when I'm really honest, when Yasher proposed this, let's do a whole podcast on self-compassion, I was in a place that day where I was like, I don't want to talk about self-compassion. I have so much to do. I actually thought that. And then I was really aware as the words came out of my mouth that I was speaking from my fear-based side of me that was feeling overwhelmed with all the things that I had on my plate. And the reality is when I step into not my fear-based reactionary mindset, but my growth mindset, the one that I actually really like to live in, I was like, of course we should be talking about self-compassion and moving that beyond a place of bubble baths and wine. And I was totally into it. But, you know, you and I, everyone on our team, we'll all jump into that places where we get into that reactive state. We're like, I just don't have time for an evolved way of thinking right now. And I think acknowledging that and being compassionate around it is part of this journey. So I wanted to share that. This conversation started with Megan having a bad attitude about it. But also, as we were engaging further in that conversation, one of the things that we came up with was this idea of doing a masterclass around this piece, because it is so universal, the need to find new ways of thinking about this and evolving ways of thinking about self-compassion, that we decided we're going to host a Neuroscience of Self-Compassion Masterclass. So we're going to get into the science of it. We're going to get into specific strategies. And this is for go-getters and entrepreneurs and high achievers and basically everyone listening. And because I'm being compassionate with myself, I don't have the date sitting in front of me, but I promise you it's in the show notes and it's on Instagram and it'll be in all the places that we're promoting. But we've already got it scheduled in. We've got it locked in. I just realized we were into this conversation and I hadn't looked it up before we started. So yeah, sure. If you remember offhand when we're doing that, feel free to jump in now. Otherwise,
I will. Would you like me to? Yes.
Do you know?
Yes, I do.
Okay. The date of our masterclass is
Monday, April 29th at 3 p.m.
Monday, April 29th at 3 p.m. So registration for this will be in the show notes. It will be in my Instagram. Yasha will have it. We'll share it with the world. Yes. Not to worry. And we're going to get really into this. And one of the things I love about our masterclass is you and I, but the ones we run for Anthropology in general, is that for people who are live on the call, there'll be an opportunity to engage in a live Q&A, which is always super cool because this man is super brilliant. So I just want to let you guys know we're going to go really deep on this. And I think at that time, we're also going to introduce the idea of the self-compassion detox and how you can participate in that.
Yes. I'm very much looking forward to that as well. There again, for those of you who want research, there'll be plenty of that. And for those of you who just want to tweak concepts and ideas and have strategies to implement, there'll also be tons of that. And my goal, again, I feel like a little bit I'm shouting from the mountaintops right now. This is such an important topic and such an important topic for the people who want to lead and grow in life and not be stuck with the same old framework of thinking. So I'm very much, again, looking forward to sharing this with anyone and everyone who's interested.
Hey, fellow go-getters. So we've got a lot going on right now over at Anthropology Performance Labs, and I want to make sure that you guys are in the loop. We have groups and contests and quizzes and meal plans and all sorts of things that you can get your hands on. And the best place for you to be in the know is actually to ensure that you are following and hanging out and engaging over on the gram. My personal handle, which is @Dr. Megan Walker, is where most of this activity is currently taking place. And so I'm going to invite all of you to come on over and to follow and to play along. This way you can engage with our weekly guests, get direct links to some of the things that they're talking about in our show notes, and have access to some of the coolest new quizzes, ideas, and games and links that we have in the pipeline over at Anthropology. Head on over to Instagram, hit follow, and let's keep in touch. My handle over there is @Dr. Megan Walker, and let's keep the conversation happening. Amazing. And this is a perfect place for us to transition to the second part of the interview. Dr. K, will you indulge me? I've got a few rapid fire KPI questions for you.
I'm ready.
Okay, ready? Number one, who is inspiring you right now?
This is not because I'm trying to win brownie points, but my wife. She is not from the science world, but how she lives her life is basically as if she read all the papers and is doing it. So it's the wisdom that she's showing with our three-year-old, the wisdom she's showing in her own life. I often say to her, I want to be more like her when I grow up.
You're so drop mic. We're done.
Hey, we're
such
done.
A pleasure.
Good night, everyone. Yes.
What is your audacious goal for the next year?
I think simply put, I love speaking, and it's also part of me that sometimes needs to work on the self-compassionate piece. So my audacious goal is to land bigger. When I say bigger, I mean 100+ people in the audience, so I can really spread the message of leadership and the science and the mindset pieces behind leadership, so we all can not only show up as our best, but love each other in the process. So it'd be 100+ people in the audience and at least 10 of them in the next year.
Love it. What do you do for fun or play?
Music and workout. Those are the two.
Amazing. What's your favorite color?
Ooh, anything vibrant. So I've been really loving the vibrant oranges and yellows and blues. That's kind of been catching my eye lately.
So on point for spring, my friend.
Yeah, I guess so.
And last question, entrepreneurism. Are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
I remember answering this question, of course, the first time I was on your podcast, and I was a little bit like, I think this and that, and I'm just going to say, screw it. You know what? Sure, you can be born with some of the tendencies, but absolutely anyone and everyone who has a passion, go learn. Our brain is so malleable. We are able to change our brains. You just have to be able to do the work. It's like someone saying, I can't work out or I can't run. I'm going to call BS right now on all of this. This is all a mindset, and then it's the dedication to put the practice in. So anyone who wants to be an entrepreneur for whatever reason, not just because, again, it's cool in society, but because you actually have a pain point you want to solve and you're passionate about it, then do the work and get better at it and connect with people and share your love and expertise with all of us.
Spoken like a true mind shift ninja. Boom! Dr. Hosra Shahi Yasher, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Megan. Always a pleasure.
I know you guys are all going to want to hook up with Dr. K, learn a little bit more about our neuroscience masterclass. If people are looking to just get some instant following gratification, where can we send them?
They can go to @drkndcoach or @mindshiftninja. Those are on the social platforms. Those are the two places where I hang out.
Amazing. Well, I can't wait to hang out with you and everybody else on April 29th. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you again, Megan.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.